Hi folks, hope you're well. My name is Jim Carl, welcoming you to the latest podcast from the Banter team. This week it's a first. It's Banter in Cars in conjunction with the Aldi Dublin International Film Festival and features a conversation with Peter Murphy and Rachel Moriarty, the directors of new Irish film Traitors. Starring Killian Scott, Traitors is about what happens when ordinary folks facing financial ruin and misery decide to kill each other to win money, all the while obeying a strict code of conduct and rules. Peter and Rachel talk about the film, the inspiration behind it, and the work which has gone into getting it from idea to screen.
Welcome along.
Thanks very much.
Is this your first time being interviewed in the back of your car?
Yes,
and definitely.
The police can't contradict that, can they?
No.
Before we start talking about Traitors, which is a pretty amazing, explosive film, give me your background. What have you been doing for the last couple of years, Rachel?
I've been working in television, making documentaries and programmes for TV, and also we have been writing and various kind of things together, developing projects. And I suppose one of the things about working in television is, well, I think we both enjoy it for a start, and you know, you do get to kind of meet a lot of people, come up against a lot of different ideas and things like that. But it also allowed us time to write and try things out and get to a stage where we had an idea we thought would make a really, really good first feature. So we did try things out beforehand. You know, that's, I think, inevitable for people.
Yeah, I mean, we went to college together and did come out with the dream of being filmmakers. But it's very hard to realise. It's very, you know, financially it's difficult to do. We made 5 shorts over a long period of time and had varying degrees of success with them. And we made some comedy for RT television over the years, and we have done things like that. But our bread and butter, kind of individually, we haven't worked together that much on, you know, general TV stuff, has been TV stuff separately we've directed. But we've always had that kind of idea that we'd stick at it and we would keep writing. We had written one feature beforehand which didn't get produced. And this one was one we really believed in. We stuck at it and spent a couple of years at it to make sure. And we kind of decided at one point, right, we were going to push then and get it to the point where we get it into production.
Okay. Aside from paying the bills, what are talents, what are the kind of skills, what are attributes do you learn in TV land? I mean, I'm always curious about that because I know so many film directors who really want to make films, who really want to make feature films, but like they end up in TV world or commercial world. I mean, what skills do you think you've learned from that? Is it keeping in line with budgets, dealing with crews? I mean, are these all things you pick up along the way?
I think it is exactly that. I think there was a stage when the film board were probably slightly suspicious of us. I mean, I think they thought...
And they're not anymore.
No, they're not. They now love us. But I think it had been quite a while since our last short, and we thought, well, we're not doing another short. We had made Waterloo Dentures, which was really successful for us and went down extremely well, and we thought, well, we're not doing another one. But we thought, from now on, we'd spend time writing, and we kind of are real believers in script. The script needed to be absolutely right before we wanted to make it, because we didn't want to mess it up. So we kept on making TV, and I think they thought, well, if you're filmmakers, you don't go and do TV, you struggle. But from our point of view, we both enjoy shoots. We enjoy the experience of being on shoots, interacting with crew and interacting with people. It's a great opportunity to meet, you know, general. You get exposed to regular people making television, which is a great... It helps you as a writer. I think it helps you as a director. And we both really enjoyed it. And writing as a team can be solitary and difficult. And you spend so long working on things that you know you're going to have to do an amount of stuff that's never going to see the light of day. You know, we wrote one feature. We really liked it. We weren't able to get it off the ground. That could be tough. Whereas TV, you produce, you make stuff, and you get great experience. And I think what we always felt was when we hit the set on day one, we're going to be efficient. We're going to have a level of, we've been on a lot of shoots. We know how to get a crew working and to make it happen quickly. And I think that was the big attribute we got from years of being on shoots and working.
Absolutely. And it is that thing of meeting people. I mean, in TV you can be on a trawler one day and in a factory the next, and and that kind of breadth of life is very kind of interesting, because it can be, if you're just writing, you are relying on, you're drawing on those things, you're drawing on your imagination, but you're also drawing on those kind of characters that you meet, you know. So I think that was quite enriching, really. And and I think we've always enjoyed it. I think that was,
I was hung over in a pet food factory once, so that was really
exciting. So you talked then about meeting interesting characters on set. So you're telling me then you met people like Harry and Vernon from Traitors on the set of some TV shows you're working on?
Well, I certainly met lots of people who were... I worked on a financial show where people were very hard up and very in debt. And I remember people saying to me, you know, if I could just get back to zero... If I could just get back to zero. And I mean, when you think of it, when people were in that much debt, and this was, you know, what did they spend their money on? Coats and houses and God knows what. But that desire to just get back to zero kind of just stuck with me a little bit, that that's, you know, sometimes things are so bleak that really you just want to get to normal. And I mean, you met people as well, Peter, in that, at that time, that were, you know, property obsessed, materialistic. Yeah.
What time are we talking about there, Rachel? Is like this 2008 or 2000?
Yeah, coming up. Well, you see, I suppose a lot of personal debt would have started just beforehand. So you would have seen the cracks maybe a little bit before 2008, where people were suddenly kind of going, hang on, I live in a council flat and I owe $100,000 on credit cards. So you were starting to see that, I suppose, maybe they're the outliers or the first people who kind of started suffering from the crash. But yeah, and then as it went on, it became more and more mainstream. And like, we knew people who had had fantastically high paying jobs and then absolutely zero overnight, as happens to Harry in the film. You know, it really was that dramatic, you know?
I mean, it's something that comes across in the film as well. I mean, like Harry's apartment is a definite example of kind of boom and bust. On the one hand, it's beautifully appointed. It overlooks the Liffey. I mean, it looks like a building down St. John Martin's Quay or thereabouts. Yeah. And like, I mean, it's gorgeous. It's the ultimate Celtic Tiger pad. But then when it all goes horribly wrong, he's sitting in his apartment going, like, okay, he's getting phone calls to the banks. How do I pay for this place?
And one of our, I think we felt very strongly that we didn't want to make a real strong commentary on people who had done that, because in a way, they didn't commit any crime by getting a job, getting paid. Mm-hmm. Banks, you know, said, you should get this mortgage, you've got this, this income is fantastic. So there was an element of, we certainly would have felt sympathy for, and absolutely felt sympathy for Harry, as someone who just went, I didn't want to, you know, owe your fortunes. I didn't want it to turn out like this. And I think a lot of people feel like we just did what everyone was doing. Society was doing that. Mm. It wasn't greed. I think there was a real sense in Ireland, people went, we got greedy. Whereas there was a sense of, there was loads of work. A property was that, it did do that. So why did you commit a crime if suddenly you were faced with something that was worth a third of what it was, you know, a year earlier? You couldn't sell it, and the bank were going to go, well, you owe us all that money. And I think for us, Harry was heroic in a way, to a certain degree, in making that decision of going, you know, and struggling to make that decision, not making an easy decision, but kind of going, well, what options have I got?
Yeah.
And a lot of people were in that position.
Yeah, and it was about worth. I mean, one of the kind of lines that we've always associated with the film is, what are you worth? And for some people, it was suddenly one day I'm a really successful estate agent, or I'm a really successful financial advisor. And then the next day I'm absolutely worthless. And it was also that idea of people being told, oh, you're 29, well, it's all downhill from now. You'll never earn as much as you did when you were 25 years old. So, you know, enjoy the rest of the journey to the grave there. Mm. But, you know, it's all downhill. And those kind of things, I suppose, were shocking people, I think, at the time, you know?
Mm. But, like, I mean, what's really interesting about traders is the fact that, like, a lot of people in those situations, you know, they decided on certain things. Many people immigrated. Many people just knuckled down and kind of, like, I mean, many people just phoned Joe Duffy. In the case of kind of Harry, he got involved. Like, I mean, Vernon came along. And that idea of what they're about, that, like, I mean, there was going to be a fight to finish mm-hmm. between two consenting adults, two desperate consenting adults, and whoever won walked away with two bags of money. And there was a strict code, strict rules. Where does the idea of that come from? Please don't tell me that you've tapped into some secret underbelly of our society that we know anything about before now.
That was always our fear, was that we'd write it and someone go, oh, you're writing about that thing that exists. No, it doesn't. We're pretty sure it doesn't exist, and we hope it never does, because obviously it's dark. But interestingly, it was the core concept. That was the concept we had outside of financial ruin or boom and bust. Mm-hmm. We thought that idea of two people doing that was what fascinated. We always had that core idea. Two people meet an isolated location, fight to the death, having turned all of their assets into cash. And then we built around that. That was and then as kind of 2008 unfolded, we thought this now has much easier resonances to fit into to modern society, because we really wanted to play internationally, because we feel it could play in countries like America, where it hasn't been quite as bleak, or as you know, they have ability to kind of declare bankruptcy quite quickly and just kickstart again, but that there is still that desperation for money exists internationally. Mm-hmm. Yeah. That you could do it from $100 to 100,000. Mm. You know, so that was always important to us, that it could exist in places where you have people who want to double up.
Yeah, we also, that, you know, and especially because it's based on the deep web, the whole idea of the code and how they communicate and all that kind of stuff. You imagine that, like, in any little area, there could be a little kind of explosion of, you know, say in Greece or something like that, you get this little kind of outburst of trading, and then maybe the traders kind of naturally kill each other off, I suppose, and then maybe it pops up somewhere else. So it kind of felt that type of viral deep web kind of feeling was quite plausible. When you're saying plausibility, the first time you think about it, you think crazy idea, but the amount of people that we pitched it to who went, how exactly does that work? And yeah, I suppose, and really kind of could see it working. And that's, I suppose, an indication of how people thought about money, maybe, and thought about doubling up.
Because I think it's possible people will find it an implausible concept, but we don't think they should. We kind of go, we find it so plausible, we think it could exist.
I don't argue about its plausibility at all. Yeah. I can well imagine what's going on. I mean, I love the way in the film as well, you build this tension after the two kind of like traders meet in a pub, and the long journey it takes to get that isolated spot. I mean, the tension builds brilliantly. It strikes me watching that it's something that could well exist on some sub thread of Reddit or somewhere else.
Yeah.
And I mean, we did always think that. And I mean, people did, like you were asking, people did ask, does it exist? Have you just, you know, done that filmmaker thing of hijacked a news story and turned it into a hook for something? We were like, no.
Full of headlines.
Actually, not this time, no.
Yeah.
You mentioned earlier on there, Peter, about like, I mean, the fact that like it's dark. It is a dark film. But there's also, you know, I found, and I have to say, I said to you before we started this interview, I also found it quite funny in places. I'm wondering, does that reflect badly on me? Or is this
it
kind
does
of. Is this,
it does, yeah,
okay,
it does.
Okay, so, you know, okay. When we finish here, we're going to go to a remote spot in West Dublin and expose the bodies.
Yeah.
But like, you know, there's some strong humour in it. The Vernon character in particular, he reminds me of kind of like one of a deranged Bashery kids from the Beano. You know, there is that sense of humour going through. Was that deliberate from the start?
I mean, it was deliberate, but we resisted temptations to go for it as a comedy. And again, people who would have worked with us over the years of developing as a script would have pushed it at times towards an out-and-out comedy. Mm-hmm. And we were always reluctant to do that because we thought it should find the comedy in very plausible situations. It should feel real Irish people. You know, there, like, I think if you do something that is a straight Irish film, there should be comedy in it. It feels like that's our nature, and that comedy should naturally happen in it. So we never pushed it. We always felt, in a way, if it felt like we were looking for a gag too much, we'd sort of pare back on it. It always had to feel like it comes naturally.
And from the absurdity of the kind of, the, like if you take Vernon, for example, he's completely logical the entire time. His scheme makes complete sense. It's completely rational to ring people up and to make these arrangements and to do all this kind of thing. And that absurdity is the source of the humour, rather than we did take out anything that was a joke per se or to play too much for laughs, you know?
I was just going to say, I don't think you can enjoy the film without finding it funny. I think all of the screenings we've been to abroad as well, particularly, it was particularly enjoyable to see it in Montreal and LA and a few other places that it screened, and it gets laughs, and that's really gratifying, actually.
Mm. Mm. How long was it developed for? I mean, like, when did you write the script in the first place, and how long did it take to get the financing together?
Oh, that's a tricky one to kind of put an exact figure on, because you do spend we certainly spent some time with the idea, and we've got to get back to Traders, we've got to figure out, and the name was there straight away, and this, as we were saying, the core concept of two people meeting, fighting to death for money. So we spent quite a bit of time throwing it back and forth, and trying to figure out whether it needed to be, do we dive right into trading? Is it a phenomenon that exists? Are we 3 years into it, and is Harry kind of the greatest in the world who's already killed a lot of people? So we looked at lots of different sort of versions of it, and then we kind of decided, we went to the film board for funding probably 2.5 years, I guess, before we went into production. And they were really keen, straight away very keen, loved it. And it was a very loose treatment. And then we set upon the start, the kind of two guys lose their job and the crazy one comes up with this idea. And then I guess that was about two and a half years from production.
Yeah, we spent a lot of time on the script. You know, we spent a lot of time, because we were just convinced that if we had a script that we really believed in every single word, was really well written, was really, you know, that would see us through quite a lot. And it did. I mean, when you are trying to make a feature film in a very limited amount of time and all the rest, having the script really as a kind of a security blanket the whole way through was really useful. So that time was, but it did, we'd spent a lot of time writing it.
Yeah. Mm. And the script, it's interesting you say that about the script, it was essential to us to get it right, because the only scene we reshot while in production was a scene that wasn't well written enough. It's funny, because we looked and we shot it on the day and we were both travelling back in the car after the shoot going, that didn't work.
You're going, and it's not the actors.
It's not the actors, no. It was a really interesting realisation how important getting a script right, because you can be there, because you can't fix it, you can't suddenly rely on actors to try and sort of improvise when that hasn't been the approach, that the script was working. I'm not sure they necessarily felt it wasn't, but we certainly knew it wasn't, and you could see that they were struggling with it. And we rewrote it over the weekend, and it worked.
Mm. Yeah.
And it was great, but we didn't have to do that anywhere else. So we realised it was worth committing to a very, you know, dedicating time to get that script right was important.
Mm. Mm. I mean, yeah, and casting as well was important. I mean, Killian Scott leaps off the screen. You know, yeah. He's fantastic. He's menacing. He's like a panther. You know, it's a really good casting. So I mean, you obviously worked with Maureen Hughes on this. Did you also, like, a lot of the actors will be familiar to people. Obviously, you know the two words they're going to use.
Yes.
Which is love hate, because it was such a hit. Did you find when you were casting a film that, like, I mean, that you found the pool a bit shallow? You know, in terms of Irish actors are there, or is it the case that it just happens to be these guys are good, that's why we know them these people from other shows such as?
I mean, I guess you use Maureen. Maureen is in that space and has worked with them in Love Hate and cast Love Hate. We had no we saw a lot of people and a lot of great talent.
Yeah.
So I think we felt the opposite. We were really kind of excited once we started working. We worked with Maureen before we were fully greenlit. We thought we sort of felt we're going to get this off the ground, but we'd love to spend a bit of time and kind of for that to feed into maybe a bit of confidence, maybe a sense of, does the script work?
We did a bit of writing, actually. We did a bit of writing as we were doing the casting.
Yeah.
Yeah, so that was good.
Can actors respond to it? Will they play off it? And that was really a positive experience.
Mm. Yeah. But I mean, I suppose as well as that, you have to remember, I suppose Ireland's a small country. We've got a shallow pool. I think it's quite a healthy pool in a way for where we're at now. I mean, and especially in terms of the ability to act for screen. There's an awful lot of people who really have that craft and that skill, thanks to things like Love Hate, where they have had a chance to, you know, learn and develop. So, no, I mean, I think we looked at a lot of people and I hope we did pick the best, I think. Mm.
Yeah.
You know?
I mean, the other thing that looks really, really well on screen is Dublin. I mean, Dublin looks swell. You know, okay, it looks sleazy and dirty and squalid as well.
Yeah.
But it looks really good, you know? When you, like, I mean, when you were doing, obviously, because you're both based here, because you work an awful lot here, you know, we and because most people who watch the film here in Ireland know Dublin and they'll know the city. Do you think we underappreciate the city as a kind of a film location sometimes?
Well, we, I suppose, went and looked. I mean, we drove around a good bit, didn't we? When I think of places like Boherne Abrina and the Quarry and things like that, our location manager was great. And we did find lots of... Yeah, there's actually quite a lot of variety around Dublin, maybe, that we don't always see. Like, there's some great locations that are not very far away. I suppose one thing about the look of the film is that we shot it in kind of cold winter light, and that was for aesthetic reasons, but also because there were a lot of crew available.
Yeah,
and
you
shoot in February and, you know, a lot of people are, you know, available to you, and it also suited the theme of the film, I suppose. But I mean, I suppose we didn't try to make it too Dublin specific either, actually. We didn't actually try and make it, this is a thing that is happening in Dublin. We actually kind of let Dublin just kind of be there when it was there naturally, but I don't think we specifically tried to...
In a way, it's interesting you say that, because some English people who would have viewed it early on felt, oh, you're not getting Dublin enough. I want to see more Dublin.
What do they mean by that?
I don't know. I think, is it like literally, is it the spire?
Of,
Is it James Joyce walking down a college street?
Exactly. I wonder, was it that? And for us, we were thinking it can't be that. It's got to feel like it could be a modern city anywhere. But I guess when you set out and start doing that, you realise Dublin is a good-looking, modern European city. It needed to feel like, and I think if you go to any city in the world, probably, if you go to the edges, it gets a little bit rougher and it gets a little bit more decrepit. And, you know, you don't have to travel far, and that decrepitude can sometimes just be, that's an old warehouse that's probably going to be on a plot of land that's going to sell for $1 million now that the boom is back. but for us it worked for our purposes. And I think one of the other big things for us was, we didn't have a huge budget naturally for our first feature, but we thought lots of locations would give it a bigger budget feel. You know, it's not that traditional two people in a room. Not that there's anything wrong with that, but it's that idea that we thought it needed a film like this. You know, we wanted plenty of cast, even though a lot of them are small cameos. We wanted those to feel like they had a bit of meat to them, and we wanted it to happen in plenty of locations. So we just, you know, it was difficult. Unit moves are a very difficult thing when you're and can be expensive.
Yeah,
but we thought
we
have to do it. We have to get to plenty of locations, or it won't make sense.
Yeah. Won't
so
feel
I think
real.
It, suddenly there was lots of Dublin in it because we were travelling about. You know?
Yeah, but not to be featured. And I suppose the main locations I remember from shooting are the men's toilets. I mean, they were just... Oh, God, I don't know how you guys deal with it. I mean, it was just... it was an eye-opener for all female crew members.
An eye-burner. For the first time, urinal cakes.
I was like, why have we all got these headaches? I don't get migraines. Why are my eyes streaming?
They're those wonderful little fluorescent things that keep...
Chlorobenzene or whatever they are. Yeah, yeah. They were really, so that was, yeah.
Did you have much kind of discussion over how violent the film's going to be? You know, I mean, like the fight scenes. You know, they're not kind of like the fight, like, I mean, if you watch an awful lot of cinema, you use a certain kind of, I suppose, high-def fight scenes, you know, things which are kind of like, I mean, like uber super real. This isn't. These are two ordinary blokes. They're not UFC fighters. They're two ordinary blokes slugging it out.
I do think some people will have a problem with it. Without a doubt, there were definitely elements of, I think there will be a fan base that will go, why isn't it the Raid?
Yes.
I love the Raid. Yes. I think the Raid is fantastic.
Yeah. And that's a different version.
And actually that was part of that discussion early on was, are we making something that needs extra money, extra time to do the big crash, bang, wallop fight sequences? But we didn't want them. We wanted it to feel like if you set something like this up, you're going to do, and if you're good at it, you're going to do what Harry does and think, I need to just figure a way to kill this person quickly without getting badly beaten up myself, without getting heroic. I just need them dead. And we always have from very early on, he goes for the throat. He figures there's going to be swashbucklers and there's going to be people who don't know how to fight. All I need to do is kill this person. So we wanted it to be as lo-fi as possible. And I think some people maybe don't like that, but it's what we wanted.
Of course, with a story about fighting, you can make it, you know, if you have, you know, 100 million, you can make a different type of movie. But I mean, when our fight coordinator actually was coming onto it, we were talking about that. It's ordinary blokes. It's guys who worked in an office till last week. And they're kind of turning up, and it's nearly a scuffle in a pub car park. And if you've ever seen anyone fight in a pub car park, they are not UFC fighters. It's not glamorous. It's, you know, and he had very interesting kind of insights. He said, if you see people fighting like that, you know, the worst thing you can have in your head is a plan. If you think I'm going to do X, Y, Z and take him out, you are going to, the very first thing that'll happen is somebody's going to just do something that's going to throw your plan. And it will descend into that. So he was very good in telling us that kind of like, if you go in with just one move, not a plan, but just one move, that's probably the most efficient thing. So that's a tip for anybody who ends up in a fight in a cup. Okay. Yeah. Just one good move, Jim.
Okay, yeah. I'll watch both of you carefully, you know. And I'm curious as well, like, you said earlier, Rachel, you were talking about, like, I mean, when you were kind of filming some kind of financial shows, people wanted to reset the button to zero.
Yeah.
Do you think any of the people you would have met would be desperate enough to get involved in a trader situation?
I don't know. I think you'd have to kind of... Well, I don't know. I certainly have met people who would certainly do things that were not necessarily legal or above board or, you know, would certainly be tempted that. I think you'd have to fancy yourself a little bit as a fighter. Yeah. I think you'd have to fancy yourself a little bit maybe to actually take it on. But yeah, I can imagine people... It's that plausibility thing. I can imagine people being desperate enough. I mean, if you think about it, that stat that Vernon spouts about iconicide in the film... That's true. I mean, people, there is a spike in suicide rates when you have a recession, so therefore there are people who are willing to do that.
Yeah, there's definitely real desperation. You know? I mean, you'd need real desperation. I don't know from that program that you worked on whether it would have been that level of desperation. I think you'd need to probably fall into it a little bit more. You need to maybe fall into a bad decision. There's probably the likes of a Vernon who might sort of suck you in a little bit. I don't think it'd be an easy thing to do.
And it also depends who you owe money to as well. There could be people who, you know what I mean? Yeah. There are certain circumstances that you would kind of go, actually, that is a better option. So, no, I think in terms of trading, the plausibility is there, but I think it just possibly needs you to be in quite a desperate circumstance, But, you know, as Vernon says, sometimes it makes perfect sense.
Okay, so the film opens in Irish screens on March 11th. What's the plan internationally? I mean, you were talking earlier on, Peter, about Montreal.
Yeah, we have a US sales agent who is selling it internationally, and they're also releasing it in the US. So we'll release on screens in the US, I think, in April or May.
It's not
fully decided. And I think they'll do a small release. They'll do a limited number of theatres, as they call them in the States, and then we'll release on, you know, various forms of VOD and DVD and things like that over there. So then they're looking at, so they're hopefully, as it progresses, we'll get more territories. So I would expect, I'd expect to be a reaction to how it does in Ireland. I think people will watch how it performs in Ireland might affect what way it sells, whether it does theatrical release abroad. What's great about here in Ireland is the cast are, what's really nice is actually the cast are stars. It's interesting, people go abroad, it's a cast of unknowns. I suppose John is known from Game of Thrones, but there's quite a big pool of Game of Thrones actors, but everyone else is an unknown. Whereas here, it's kind of a cast of stars, which is kind of great fun, actually. It's good that Killian is the star, and is a star, and as are quite a few of the people in it, you know. So it's great to feel like it has commercial potential here. I think it's tricky. You never want to go into something thinking too commercially about it. You've got to make the film for what it is. But we always did feel it had commercial potential, you know, that it feels like it can be seen, it can find an audience.
Enjoyable cameos as well. It's that type of the structure of it is the enjoyable. I mean, I know a lot of people who did it just like love those little cameos. If you're a fan of that type of movie as well, I think it's quite enjoyable. You will recognise the faces they'll be doing, you know, particular roles and
You get a call from someone and go, Dave McSavage is in it.
Dave McSavage is fantastic in it.
Yeah.
It won't spoil the surprise, but he's fantastic in it. So what's next to the two of you doing finally? You know, is it time to dust off that feature that didn't get made and rewrite that, or is there something else you've got to up your sleeves?
Something else. I think I mean, not that we're opposed to dusting off, because we've actually a couple of features that we love and we have written, but it feels like the momentum is there, and we have an idea that we've been working on for the last few months that we're very excited about. It's in a similar space to Traders in terms of the desperate decisions people make for financial reasons. So we'd be hopeful to make another feature in the next couple of years.
Yeah, very much in the same vein. And I think that, you know, it is that thing of, I suppose, once you make a feature, people seem to like this and seem to like the kind of area that it's in. So the particular project that we're working on next is very much in the same area.
Great, excellent. Best luck with the film. And Peter and Rachel, thank you very much for joining me in the very first Bantering Cars. Thank you very much.
It was very comfortable. Fantastic,
Thanks again to Peter and Rachel for their time, and to all at the Dublin International Film Festival for their help in making this happen. Traders will open in general release in Irish cinemas on March 11th. Check out thisisbanter.com for news of our up-to-date banter. Plus, you can also listen back to all the Banter podcasts to date. We'll be back next week with another podcast. Until then, goodbye and take care.